Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey, Ben, I love you.
Chris Casso.
Hello.
And Nicole Lamb.
Hi.
Hello. How is everybody?
Lovely.
I just like really distracted.
Giving Cole crap before we start rolling. Just get him in a mood.
Yeah, but you don't want that mood. You don't want that mood.
All right. So, how is everybody today? It's today's episode 120. Can you believe it? 100. We've done 120. We've done 119.1 of these things now.
Sure. By the way, we are recording on a Friday night, which
we are
is not our regular MO.
I'm all out of whack.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. There's a rave going on outside.
Yeah, so. because it's Friday night and
everybody likes it. It's Friday, it's time to party.
Yeah.
I'm waiting
next to a bar and the pot store next to us. So yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
But if someone started playing polka at the accordion store, it'd be complete.
Oh, there you go.
But they're closed now.
God, there's something to get up in the morning for now.
Polka rave?
Yes. Yeah.
A polka rave, yes.
But I mean, we frequently are challenged energy-wise, like when we record on a Wednesday night, but good grief, at the end of a long week.
Yeah, but you know, I don't have to get up for work in the morning, so yeah, there's that.
That's a plus. Right. Yeah. You guys have to work tomorrow?
Yeah.
You, Chris does.
Yeah. All right.
So, does that mean you're not going to go have a beer with us afterwards?
Depends when what time we're at.
So let's get to our first topic, friends.
Five more questions.
Okay.
So when we first started doing this, you guys handed me Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics, mm-hmm. and I read it and really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, oddly enough, it was recommended to me by someone else, completely unrelated. So that got me. And I got a couple of books for my. For my birthday this year, one is, I can't remember, I think it's The Gallery of Regrettable Superheroes, or maybe The Legion. Legion of Regrettable Superheroes. And it's basically just, you know, it goes through all these one-off or not very well-known superheroes from the Golden Age up until present day. Mm-hmm. And I started reading, it's pretty interesting. I've never heard of any of these characters.
There's a sister book out now, The Villains.
The Villains, excellent.
Now, yeah.
So I was wondering what other books out there are about comics but not comics themselves.
I came across this really cool book that I did not come across. Our Panel Jumper embedded photographer, Danny Chong, recommended this book. It's called Masterful Marks by Monty Beauchamp, and it was printed a couple of years ago. Let me quick get to the copyright page. 2014. And what it is a series of different... it's biographical pieces devoted to cartoonists and comic book creators, but drawn by different fans, or at least professionals who became fans. So, and it's a really wide range of folks, many illustrators, many of whom I'm not familiar with. So, for example, there's the story of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman, drawn by Ryan Heschka and Monty Beauchamp. And there's one about Jack Kirby by Mark Allen Stamati. And there's one about Charles Adams, the creator of the Adams Family by Mark Rosenthal. And they are, these stories are all, these biographical pieces are all clearly done by folks who are the fans of these creators. And they kind of walk this weird line between aping, parroting, and honoring the style of those creators, or just taking them as inspiration. Now, case in point is there's a piece on Walt Disney done by Larry Day and Monty Beauchamp, but there are no Disney characters seen in there anywhere because copyright and, you know, major corporate attorneys will sue your pants off and the pants off of your children and all of your ancestors. but then there's this really lovely one about Dr. Seuss done by Dennis Kitchen, and it's... all done in the style of Dr. Seuss, and also there are plenty of, or similar style to Dr. Seuss's illustration, but there are you know, plenty of Dr. Seuss characters all throughout the panels. Kitchen doesn't have any qualms about using those characters. They're clearly all, you know, copywritten characters. And I learned a lot. I learned some really cool things, particularly about the creator of, Tezuka, the creator of Astro Boy. And I didn't realize Tezuka was such a fertile creator and did more than just these sort of, was more than just the grandfather of anime and manga. He created entire universes of characters that were contained and then overlapped. And I'm like, wow, I had no idea. So, I thought this is a really fun, really inspired book, and I highly recommend it because I learned things that I didn't know I needed to learn, which is always a good thing to get from a book.
Yeah.
Cool.
Did you want to look at this?
Hmm? Oh, okay.
That one is all illustrated
by 16. There's 16 different biographies, yeah. All done by 16 different creators.
Yeah, because I was trying to think of ones that weren't actual comic books, and there's history things that, like, Trina Robbins has done a ton of them.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I got was from years ago called Pretty in Ink, and it was about women cartoonists. It's not a complete... she focuses a lot on really specific people, and there's a lot of modern cartoonists that she leaves out, but it's still very interesting to read about the few that she does talk about.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big oversized book, and it's got a lot of different artists' renditions and things in there too that you can check out.
What was the name of the book she did about female characters from the Golden Age? Do you remember?
I feel like she's done like 10 or 15 of these things. I mean, she does a lot.
But I remember seeing her speak at a women's science fiction convention years ago, and she was introducing that book, and it was a really interesting talk, and now I'm blanking on the name of the book.
You are currently picking up the comic book history of comics.
Though. I am, yeah, but they're comics about comic book history.
But they're very in-depth history.
And yeah, they're very interesting.
Fred Van Lente, who did the play that that's all about how Jack Kirby got screwed. And
King Kirby,
yeah.
Which I saw they did here in Seattle last year, which is marvelous.
Yeah, so Van Lente has a whole series of comics that's nothing but that kind of stuff.
I had no idea.
Yeah, they're really really good, and they're done in the funny tone.
Yeah, they're pretty dense, though. I mean, just dense. They're very, very dense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are coming out right now by IDW.
Yeah, so that's just rounded out its last issue, so it'll probably be collected.
It's called, remind me?
It is Comic Book History of Comics.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So we'll show you a copy afterwards.
Okay. Yeah, it's pretty great.
Cool. So there's that. I was going to mention Fantagraphics released a book called We Told You So, Comics as Art.
Mm.
It's exactly what it sounds like. It's them basically being like, neener, neener, we told you so. but it's not like anecdotal, so it's kind of great because it's like warts and all. It's all like the backroom stuff of their company, and as they've been trying to get the word out that comics are a viable form of artwork. It's worth always mentioning the Steranko history of comics.
Mm-hmm.
One reason because, he slapped Bob Kane, so it's like, I'll listen to him, But
that's right. I was like, literally or figuratively?
Literally.
Well, we don't know. It's become mythic.
It's
but
mythic,
we don't know if it's true or not.
And by the by,
Batman and Bill, the Hulu documentary about Bill Finger, is now available for viewing on Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
So,
nice.
Yeah.
My question about that is, do I have to have a Hulu subscription to watch it?
Probably, but I think I know that I have never used it, so I get a freebie. So, anyway.
I'd love to see it.
You get like a limited viewing, I think, if you don't. You have to watch a lot of commercials.
But they also have the Doomed documentary,
too. I don't want to pay for commercials.
About the 80s Fantastic Four film.
The Roger Corman one?
The Roger Corman one.
Yeah.
There's a documentary about that.
There is?
Yeah.
Neat.
Yeah.
I want to watch that too.
That sounds neat.
Doomed.
Fantagraphics also published the Heroes of Comics and More Heroes of Comics, which is Drew Friedman doing portraits of comic book creators.
So I was going to mention, that's really cool.
Yeah. And so they're really fantastic portrait series.
Neat.
And with a breakdown of each creator and what they're known for. So if you're just kind of looking for a listing of the who's who of Golden Age and Silver Age creators, these are pretty awesome. A lot of people that you might not be familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Just flipping pages and I'm hitting Angelo Torres, Bill Vigoda, Hi Vigoda, James Warren.
I did see Gray Morrow. I know who Gray Morrow is.
So those are really cool. They're huge too.
Yeah, nice oversized book. portrait on the right, and then a little snippet on the left. Mm-hmm. So each person gets 2 pages.
This one's kind of an odd one, but it's getting into like the gears of comics. And Todd Klein is a letterer, and he has just a small little website. It's very sparse as far as design elements go, but he'll just kind of one day post a thing of like, here's 20 different versions of Green Lantern's cover, a title that I sent to DC. Ooh. And this is an explanation as to what they were looking at and how I did it. It's definitely something you're not going to be reading for too long, but it's actually like kind of fascinating to see those bits and pieces come together. Mm-hmm. And then he'll also just put like, I just read a comic yesterday. Here's what I think about it in one paragraph. He's
just
kind
like
of
his
endearing.
Journal kind
yeah,
of.
It's like
yeah.
his journal, you know. But like he was just talking about, he did a logo for Cyclops, and it was a fascinating design. And but Marvel was just like, it's too fascinating. We don't want it. It's mm-hmm. a Cyclops. And then he showed like 6 other versions, and one of them was used like 2 years ago, and they never told him. So it's like,
ooh,
stuff.
Ooh, dirty pool.
No, yeah. No, they paid for it.
Oh, well, it's right. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like they buy these things in mass. Mm-hmm. And so they have like 50 logos for Storm that somebody did. And depending on when they're going to do another Storm miniseries, they're like, get the file cabinet out.
Yep.
And there it is. Yep. That's how this stuff works.
Wow. TV shows do the same thing. They'll buy up properties they may never do anything with.
Yep.
They buy up ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's fascinating. Klein Letters, Klein.
You include those in your Comics Dungeon rants.
Yeah, yeah. From time to time.
Yeah.
You know?
That's great.
Not all the time, because again, it's the minutiae detail. So it's like, wow, you have to be me to care about this.
But I think, but I appreciate you including those because, you know, graphic design is an unappreciated art, or graphic art in particular is unappreciated. But mm-hmm. you know, someone's got to make those logos,
yeah.
and there is actually a collaborative process, sometimes severely annoying collaborative process that goes on.
Identify the graphic designer in the room.
Actually, recovering or recovered or quit. Let's say quit. I quit.
Former graphic designer.
Former.
I also say this is a website worth following. It's cartoonmuseum.org. It's the British cartoon and comic art from 18th century to the present day. They currently have like a, right now they have the Inking Women, 80 diverse artists following the evolution of British women artists and satirists, humorists, and storytellers. So that they have a full-on museum that's just tons of fantastic details of comic history, but in some of it might touch on American, but a lot of it's British. Mm. So that was a cool one that I found, and
neat.
That's all I got.
That's
written
a
down
pretty.
There.
That's a hefty list.
Yeah,
yeah, it's pretty good. I didn't know how much would be able to fill this out, you know. Yeah. But yeah, it's pretty good.
One of my favorite books that I have is Gary Larson's compendium on the Far Side. I think it's like the Far Side's 10th anniversary or something. And it's basically a book he put together talking about his journey from being a struggling cartoonist to being Gary Larson, who draws the Far Side. And little tidbits and stories behind like some of the more controversial comics. And I just find it completely fascinating. I've read the book probably 3 times. Mm. I don't reread books all that often, but seeing these examples of the stories behind the stories is really interesting, so I might want to pick some of these up.
Especially if it's a work that is particularly inspired, then I want it. You know, I really am intrigued how you got to that point, what the backstory was, what inspired you to create that, because that's not always true, you know. But if it's, especially if it's a work that's successfully improving the test of time, which mm-hmm. like the Far Side is to a certain extent, it's cool stuff.
It's just like, you know, making of documentaries for movies. I'm obsessed with those. If there's one, I have to watch it. It's kind of similar. Like, you get those stories. That's why I like the comic book history, because you're getting some things, whether, you know, scandalous or boring or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. it's just interesting to get that backstory on it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
These books are the DVD extras of the comic books.
That's what they feel like to me. Yeah.
All righty. Cool. Well, friends, let's move on and let's talk about keeping on the comics agenda, because that's why we're here. So with all the different mediums that are out there, comics and movies and books and graffiti on the sides of the walls, let's talk about what's unique This is a kind of like a pretty grand topic, but let's drill down to what kind of different things can be done in comics that other media can't do, like instances of interesting panel layout or what makes comics more interesting.
So what brought that in my head was one of my favorite comic series was a series called Akiko by Mark Crilly. And it was an all-ages comic, and somewhere later in the series, he was just experimenting, and the main character, jumped through different dimensions, and he would change inking styles of characters to let you know that they were from a different dimension. Some were heavily inked, some were just kind of lightly penciled in or something like that. They were a different dimension. But what was great was there was an issue where there were three stories in the entire issue, but they were told on the top of the comic, the middle of the comic, and the bottom of the comic. So every page was a continuation of all three stories. And at some point in the top of the comic, the main character was trapped in a chasm by a monster and he was about to die. And in the middle of the comic, the main characters were given a guided tour through a museum of weapons. And at some point, the character in the top story broke the panel and grabbed a gun from the museum in the bottom series story and used it to get his way out of the story. So something like that, where it was just sort of didn't see it coming. And that was inventive. It was fun. And it's something that I thought you could only really do in a comic, because how else can you read three stories at the same time? Right, sure. So
with filmmaking, you realize the limitations of filmmaking language when you're reading comic books. They're both visual narratives, but a film director, an auteur particularly, can have their very their very particular mise en scène. Like let's say Ridley Scott not Wes Craven, Wes Anderson. Sorry. Wes Anderson meticulously picks his color palettes and the imagery and the props and the set design. But when it comes to comic books, if you have an auteur creator, they're dictating the whole reality.
Right.
And I've been looking at a lot of Will Eisner's stuff lately, where, he was the first person to really incorporate cinematic scene elements into the story, where his, his covers were always different. The Spirit logo was never necessarily in the same place and utilized the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And other artists since then have honored that and taken that on. And therefore, that creator is generating their own rules of storytelling, like Chris was talking about. An auteur director can do that, but a comic book illustrator, a comic book creator, especially a writer, artist, Friday night, folks. They have a lot more say in that process, and now it's more commonplace. But back in the '60s, I think it was you had people like Jim Steranko who were playing with that, and Will Eisner. But Steranko was aping a lot of Eisner's stuff anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Grant Morrison did Multiversity for DC, and in the center of the story, there's his tribute to Watchmen, where basically, what if the Charlton characters, the Question and the Atom, became the Watchmen characters, like they were meant to be? And in that one sequence, the story was told backwards and forwards at the same time, because it was about their version of Dr. Manhattan realizing that the universe is like a comic book, because it is in his reality. And so he's reading it in different orders and it's jumping around, and the paneling starts to take forms of subplots of the story, because the organization is the Janus organization, the Two-Face Roman God, and it's looking in both directions of the comic as you read it. And so you get stuff like that happening. And then later on, one of the alternate realities is our reality, and there's a comic book character that is actually infecting realities by sending comics to those realities that have a meme bomb in them. And so many times the character would look at you saying, "Don't read this. You're responsible for this disaster if you turn the next page." So, you could almost get things like that in cinema, but not to the same effect of the playing with the concepts of like, these are universes that you put down and open back up and they're experiencing them at your leisure. Mm-hmm.
You can get them in like storybook form. I've had some of those like, don't go to the next page thing. But what is different about what you're describing is it's a comic book with a comic book history. There's like a lot more things woven into it than it just being some standalone story of something getting meta. It's right. like meta within a meta, you know, and it's stories within a story woven forward and backward. So it puts so many elements in there that the comic book element is also part of the storytelling. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting.
Yeah.
Neat. What other, before we move on, what other instances of clever paneling and layouts? Anything jump out? When you think back on all the comics that you've read, what kind of pops out at you at the way they've messed with you?
Well, Chris Baclow, who is frequently vilified by a lot of people I know, but I've been rereading Wolverine and the X-Men from 2012. He plays with form and space in a really unique way. It didn't work for that X-Men book, but I enjoyed looking at his stuff. What it really works for is his current work on Doctor Strange, because so much of what Doctor Strange is about bending reality. So you have this very visually bent reality where things overlapped and interconnect, and I actually am conscious of his illustrations when I'm reading it. Partly because of the way he plays with form and human physiology, but also because there are just times where I have to stop and go, what am I looking at? What am I looking at? Because it's such an obtuse angle, or, you know, he's constantly challenging the viewer with the choices he makes and how the pages are constructed. I appreciate that. Now, don't get me wrong. I find it super annoying about 50% of the time because I keep getting jerked out of whatever narrative is happening. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people don't like that. But at the same time, I'm like, well, hats off to you there, old Chris, because, you know, that takes some time. And what I've noticed in a lot of his books is he can't keep up a regular schedule, and he has someone who's alternating the title with him. I can't remember who alternates with him on Doctor Strange, but it's like sometimes it's every other issue. But sometimes he's doing one out of every three. Mm-hmm. And when you look at his artwork, you go, okay, can't blame you.
Cool. This is a minor one, but the artist of Fables, who why am I blacking out completely on? It's not Willingham is the writer, and the artist has inked Chris Baclow, where we're like in the same page here. Anyway, this guy, he started to include additional designs to all of his page work as the series progressed, and they would increase the tone of the story for me completely. Like, depending where the fable was taking place, and it was a flourish that started to give you a different sense of tone and atmosphere. And I mean, that's something that you can also say can be done in almost any other medium, but he managed to really capture it more than I've seen in other people's work. So I always love that. It's one of the reasons I love the first run of Fables. In my brain, there's more than one run just because I consider it had an ending and then they kept going. But why can I not remember his name?
All right. Well, Cole is looking it up for you, and he'll tell you.
I am, and I'm absolutely no help whatsoever.
Pretty much in any Tom King thing.
Mark Buckingham.
There you go.
Oh, Buckingham. Yeah. Willingham, Buckingham. They're so close.
Yes. All the hams.
Anything that you read by Tom King is going to have some really, even though he's not the artist, he has some really specific ways that he wants to have the panels like laid out. He does a lot of 9-panel work. And in Omega Men, he specifically did some paneling where with each page, the 9-page panel would start to collapse in on itself, so like the top row would become all one, the middle, and then it got into a big splash page, and then it counted back up into 9 panels.
Interesting.
And it was very specific. I also feel like the play with Black Monday murders and what's happening there, the intermingling, mm-hmm. I feel like you could probably use that in certain ways in other media, but I feel like in the print form, in what it is, it's like kind of mixed media.
Yeah.
And it does make a difference in the tonal washes on things, where they are, who they're talking to, all these little subtle things that play into the visual narrative and is so very, very intentional. That I think it makes it really unique because you could look at a comic book face value, not see it. But if you looked a little bit deeper, you'd go like, ah. Mm. And I love those things, to being able to discover it. So
cool. Emily Carroll. Yes. I was trying to remember and then I forgot. Yes. And then I remembered.
Yes.
So she does a lot of print comics, but she does web comics. And she's done a few that I don't believe can ever be printed. And I forget the name of the story, but there's one where the main character found some blood, and then the story follows the trail of blood, and it moves in a way that can only be seen online. And Scott McCloud has called that the infinite canvas, mm-hmm. and it's the fact that there is no limit to your space on the mm-hmm. webcomic. You could do virtually anything.
Right.
He actually did a TED Talk about the infinite right. canvas, and it's worth looking if you get the chance, where there can be so many different innovations now due to this type of media expansion for comics. And but Emily Carroll was one of the ones that really popped up in my mind because she does beautiful storytelling anyway, but that she kind of found a way to turn this gruesome thing into a horribly beautiful Where's Waldo kind of like looking for the puzzle, like where's this murder going to be on the canvas kind of deal. So yeah.
Well, maybe if we go back to the scrolls of olden time, then maybe we can print webcomics. Because then it could just be an endless roll, you know.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, great. Well, that's just one of the ways that comics differ from other mediums in terms of what they can contribute to storytelling. I'm sure we'll come back to this as we think of more things to say. But let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And Cole Hornaday,
yes.
What have you got in front of you?
Oh, my goodness. Well,
I know you've been waiting to talk about this.
I have been waiting to talk about this. This is one of those times where I feel sad and foolish and ecstatic all at the same time, because I just this last couple of weeks discovered Alison Bechdel's Fun Home, and this is a book. This is a graphic novel memoir that she wrote back in 2006, so 15 years ago, and it is her. It is her. It's the story of her family. It is her story. It is her coming out story. It is about revealing secrets, and it's about self discovery. And it also inspired an 8-time Tony Award-winning musical, which as soon as I got done reading the graphic novel, I went out and bought the musical. It's been in constant rotation in my car because it's brilliant. So Fun Home is actually short for Funeral Home. Allison was raised by in a very loveless family, and she essentially was raised by her father, Bruce, and her mother, and I can't remember her mother's name right now, but Bruce was a very closeted gay man. They're living in rural Pennsylvania. He is obsessively devoted to restoring their house into, it's this farmhouse, I guess a pseudo mansion, maybe not quite, but you know, he's all about the loving details that he puts into this house. The love that he puts into the house is not the love that he gives his family. So it's about the secret life that he leads, and then Alice's progress through self-discovery and coming out and realizing her sexuality as a lesbian. It is beautifully illustrated. It's all done in a black and white and blue wash. She is an incredibly articulate person. Her mom and her dad were both very literary-minded people, and she has adopted the language that is found in the books that she grew up reading, or perhaps her father foisted on her, like Proust and Fitzgerald and whatnot. I could not put this down. And the whole time I'm reading it, I'm going, man, I'm so sorry I didn't discover this sooner, but man, I'm having the best time reading this now. I do, Nicole, before we recorded, Nicole and I were talking about the sequel, mm-hmm. which is called Are You My Mother?
Yep.
Which I have not read yet. And she said, Nicole said she had a difficult time with it. And I almost, at this point, don't want to read it because, yes, the story is bittersweet. Yes, you struggle with Allison trying to find herself and working against this cold opposing force of both her mom and dad to be this incredibly gifted, outspoken artist and poet. But what is fascinating to me is to go from watching Fun Home. Oh, let me try this one more time. Reading Fun Home to listening to the Broadway musical, which is someone else's interpretation of her life story, which has got to be really wild to have mm-hmm. someone take your memoir that you drew and put your heart and your soul and your poetry into, and then have someone else be inspired to stage a musical and make music from your images and your words, and then have it be such a phenomenal success. I highly recommend both.
Cool. All right. Was Fun Home her first book?
No, she had a book called Dykes.
Dykes to Watch Out For.
Dykes to Watch Out For. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just Dykes. And of course, for years, I've only known Bechdel from the what?
The Bechdel test. The Bechdel test. Which came out of the comic strip.
Which is kind of just gives you some insight into just how incredibly smart and witty this woman is.
All right. Cool. Fun Home by Allison Bechdel. Thanks, Cole. Sure. Nicole Lamb, what do you got for us?
I read Black Bolt number one. This is something we had talked about in a previous podcast coming out. All of you were very not into it. And I was like, I'm looking forward to it. This is written by Saladin Ahmed, and art is by Christian Ward. The way I know Christian Ward is through the Ultimates. He did some fill-in pages for the first run of the Ultimates, and I really like that. He also did a series with Matt Fraction called Odyssey, which is the Homer's Odyssey, yeah. But it's a gender swapped one. Mm-hmm. I didn't read that because it didn't interest me, but his art is very cool. So this gives you right off the bat a blurb of kind of the context to go within the Black Bolt, because it does start after other stories, kind of similar to Black Panther, but I feel like it was less hard to track. So he finds himself in some prison. He it's like swapped places with his brother Maximus. It's just like really linear story. There's a lot of narrative, like he has been bound, he has been chained, he has been muzzled, and it's like very like flourished in like the narrative and stuff. And you see him and he's got a mask over his face. His hands are bound. And there's something screaming around him, like, name your crimes, repent your crimes. And it's him busting out of that and kind of trying to figure out what's going on. There's just gorgeous art style throughout with Christian Ward and the colors. He finds himself coming in contact with other people, including the Absorbing Man, who wants to break his face in. But he finds out that like nobody has powers. But he's like, but I probably still do, right? So like Absorbing Man punches him in the face, injures his little mask that had been on, but he's like, I will save it for finding whoever is at the center of this place, you know, and I'll work that on them. And then he tries to whisper something at this being that he comes across, and
don't spoil it.
and then things happen. Sometimes we spoil things on this show, but you don't want me to.
It's a number one that's pretty fresh, and that's actually like the big reveal at the end, I think. So
the one thing that's, I'm sorry, Nicole, are you gonna?
No, go ahead.
The one thing that's always troubled me about the mystery of Black Bolt is that we know he can't speak mm-hmm. because he will destroy the universe if he speaks.
Yeah.
But we never know what he's thinking.
We did for a while.
We did?
During the Paul Jenkins run, they did like breakdowns of his mental thoughts as he's going through it.
All right. Okay. I did read, was
Paul Jenkins?
No, I did not read that. Okay, I remember the Jay Lee series.
That's the same series.
Okay, all right.
But he's also able to go into like a dream world and speak with Medusa.
Yeah.
Right.
So there are times when you can see him conversing, but it's not in a reality because otherwise he would kill everybody and shatter them. So I know Saladin Ahmed talked about how he really wants to take on like talking about incarceration and all these different things. Within this first issue, like I said, it's very linear. I feel like the drawing point for me right now is Christian Ward. But I'll have to see what Ahmed does and how he deepens it. The one thing that I noticed, because I think Ahmed is actually a novelist, and this is possibly first work with comics, if I remember correctly.
Sounds right.
And the one thing that I noticed a difference is in his narrations that I talked about, there's a difference. Like when you're doing just prose, you have to create the flourish. You have to create it with your words. And in comics, you have to have a synergy with an artist and let some of the visuals take over and complement it and kind of have this back and forth. And it felt a bit disconnected. So he does need to still have a little bit of footing. Like he put so much flourish into some of the narrative that I was like, well, I don't need that. I'm looking at Christian Ward's art. It's gorgeous. Right. You know, like I you know, a little less is more in this situation. So it'll be interesting to see if that evolves for him, or if it stays the same and how that will ultimately affect the storyline. But overall, I am still very excited to follow this. I hope Christian Ward is able to stay on the title because I know that art is not always at the forefront of comics for some reason. So, yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah. Is this a new design conceit that Black Bolt's little forehead prongy things are now a manifestation of energy as opposed to a literal piece of jewelry?
I think that's just the artist doing
whatever. Yeah, I think that might just be
totally
Ward.
Digging that. That's cool.
Yeah, Ward stuff is pretty like it's got psychedelic elements to it, and he plays with a lot of different coloring in it.
Prongy thing. That's
the prongy thing. Yeah. Tuning fork.
Technical
whatever.
Term.
Technical term. All right. Black Bolt number one. Thanks, Nicole. Mm-hmm. And finally, Chris Casso. What do you got for us, sir?
I read the first issue of Damned from Oni. This is the return to a series similarly titled Damned. And it's by Colin Bunn and Brian Hurt, the exact same creative team of The Sixth Gun, which is one of my favorite comics. And I just do not know what it is about Colin Bunn and Brian Hurt, but every time I read something else Colin Bunn does, it's nowhere near as good as when he's with Brian Hurt. Damned is basically... Hellboy and Sin City mushed together. It's 1920s gangster style storytelling, but there are demons roaming the streets, and people who have died or have sinned just enough can see the demons, and otherwise everybody else is kind of spared. And the main character is cursed. Anytime that he's near death, if he manages to touch somebody else, they die for him. And so he can always kind of push back his inevitable death at some point, but it's not going to do any good for his soul. And the previous series, I absolutely loved it. A new printing of that just came out. So I will recommend starting from there. But the nice thing is you really don't have to. You can start fresh with this series. The number one is only $1 too. Oni really wants you to try it and get on. And if you've ever read The Sixth Gun, you will love this, I think. It's a just dense story, well designed, engaging characters. So yeah, The Damned number one.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Chris. And that is Bookport, and that is our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. And Comics Dungeon here, 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes or perfectboundpodcast.com.
Hey,
anyway,
be one of our Patreon supporters.
Be one of our Patreon supporters. Go to patreon.com/thepaneljumper and we put out 2 episodes a year. You won't even notice it coming out of your credit card. Swear to God.
But they're darn good episodes, Ben Lawrence.
They are darn good episodes. And send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com, where you can talk to us and send us quiz time questions. And that brings us to quiz time. This week, our quiz time is brought to us by Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, Cole.
Sure. This quiz is devoted to the triumphantly under tall, a.k.a. short people. And what, pray tell, designates a short person? Well, according to the immortal words of Mr. Randy Newman, they got little hands and little eyes. They walk around telling big, big lies. They got little noses and tiny little feet. They wear platform shoes on their nasty little feet. Let's begin! He was one of the earliest members of the Canadian superhero team Alpha Flight. Please name this gifted acrobat and diminutive soldier of fortune.
Puck.
Puck. That's right. Eugene Judd was created by John Byrne, first appeared in Alpha Flight, Volume 1, Number 1 in 1983. Able to reduce his size and mass to microscopic proportions, this tiny titan has been a key component to the molecular structure of the DC Universe since his arrival.
The Atom.
Ray Palmer, the Atom, the modern age Atom, first appeared in DC Showcase number 34 in October 1961. Bonus question, Chris. Since that one was pretty much a gimme, please name the original masked mystery man that used the Atom moniker in the original Justice Society of America in the 1940s.
Al Pratt first appeared
in All-American Comics number 19 in 1939. This superhero identity was but one of many shouldered by this individual. In addition to Yellowjacket, Goliath, and Giant Man, he's the inventor of those size-altering Pym particles and creator of Ultron. Not Tony Stark, as depicted in the MCU. Who is this guy?
Hit a button.
Hank Pym,
Ant-Man, who was the second person to wear the ant mantle?
Scott Lang.
Hank Pym, Ant-Man, first appeared in Tales of Astonish number 27 in January 1962. Scott Lang first appeared as Ant-Man in Marvel premiere number 47 in April 1979. Originally created by Will Eisner in 1939, he was the first ever superhero with a shrinking power. The World's Mightiest Mite originally debuted in Quality Comics, but eventually was incorporated into the DC Universe.
Doll Man,
a.k.a. Daryl Dane, first appeared in Feature Comics number 27 in 1939. It was revealed in Uncle Sam and the Freedom Fighters, Volume 2, Number 3, November 2007. Hold on, it's worth it. Dane was the leader of a subversive group of doll-sized soldiers. However, years spent at a compressed size had done damage to his mental health. Mental health traumatizing his tiny little brain. Forgive me, this was my moment to step on my soapbox. This is my moment to step on my soapbox. Bear with me a moment as I elevate my position in order to better be seen and heard. Actor Hugh Jackman is a slight 6'2" and weighs in at roughly 182 pounds. Though his performances as the X-Men Wolverine in 9 films of the X-Men franchise ranged from serviceable to sublime, he was terribly miscast in the role. According to the Marvel Universe lore, what is Wolverine's literary height?
5'3"?
You guys!
5'3"?
Hey, if they can make Chris Evans like a little waify guy, even though he was a big muscly man.
5'3", Nicole. I am 5'3".
I am 5'3", too. We're the Coles. James. I get it.
I think Tony Stark has to stand on like a box of apples or something.
I don't give a rip about him. Yeah, Wolverine, Wolverine. Okay. James Hallett, a.k.a. Wolverine, or The Wolverine, or Logan, or Weapon X, or Patch, was created by Len Wein and Herb Trimp and first appeared in Incredible Hulk number 181 in 1974. And with that, I close with another snatch of lyrics from the inestimable Mr. Newman. Short people are just the same as you and I. A fool such as I. All men are brothers until the day they die. It's a wonderful world. A song was written to be ironic, and sadly, irony is a concept as frequently lost on listeners in 1977 as it is in 2017. I can only encourage you to please read more, listen more, and spend less time spiking facts on Satan's handball course, better known as social media. Spend more time with the people willing to treat you with love and respect. This is Cole Hornaday, and I'm exhausted. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Cole, for that, and I appreciate
the
word.
So there was a soapbox.
It was there.
A mighty, mighty soapbox.
I like my friend Paul and I came up with this joke. How big of an Ackman? A huge Ackman.
Oh, I like it.
And with that, we're going to say goodbye.
Okay.
And we will see you next week. These are the jokes.